Today I'll tell you some of the work we've done on the evolution of large biomolecular networks, in particular under the processes of duplication divergence of individual genes and also large section of the genomes or even the whole genomes. So this, before I forget, this work was done with Eric Kirill Evlampiev, who has a PhD in my group, and Marco Costantino Lagomarsino, a postdoc, both very talented young researchers. So obviously, as all of you know, all of us know, life exhibits a great complexity and diversity despite the rather limited number of genes that each organism has, and moreover, despite the fact that these few genes are very similar from one species to another, and that became quite clear over the last 10 years with these whole genome sequence projects. Where the part of the genes that had no match just shrank as more and more as the various projects came to completion. All right, and this is also obviously the signature that this organism evolved by duplication, divergence of pre-existing genes and genomes. So obviously that does not explain this great complexity and diversity of this organism, and this can only be captured by some sort of a combinatorial aspect of the expression of these genes, and this is illustrated here with this initiation complex for transcription, whereby a whole set of cofactors and transcription factors and cofactors are recruited to make the decision whether to express a particular gene. So there is not only the combinatorics of these interactions, but also the logic behind whether a particular cofactor should be here or not here, and when it's here with in combination with a few others. So obviously this can become very complex, and that's most likely where all this complexity and diversity may arise. So that's the kind of the real picture, and obviously this is quite complicated. So the idea here is maybe to try to address some aspect of this problem with a very crude approach, where you abstract this complex system with a kind of graph-like approach. So here it's illustrated with this well-known picture of a protein-protein interaction network, where each node corresponds to a gene or a protein, and the edges correspond to interactions between these genes. So here this is the set of interactions, binary interactions between the proteins. So obviously it captures some of the combinatorics of these complex interactions, saying, for instance, that this center proteins can interact with a bunch of other partners, but obviously at this level we kind of forget or neglect the logic. So we don't really know whether this protein 1 and protein 2 interact together or cannot interact together, or this. So we've just forgotten this. At some point we'll see that maybe we can recover some of this aspect as well. So if we are interested in this abstract representation of networks, well, now we have to describe this graph. So you introduce some well-known quantities like the number of edges, number of node with a given degree, k. You'd like obviously to make to look at the fraction of node with a given k, so you construct this quantity pk, degree distribution, the mean degree, and so on. So these guys are some sort of local property of the network. Then you may want to introduce non-local properties like the property of neighbors of a given node k. So like here, you look at the average connectivity of the neighbor of a node k. So that tells you about the first neighbor here. You may want to look at what is called the clustering coefficient, how these neighbors are connected to one another as well. So this is sort of quantities that you may want to look at. So as you obviously all of you know, this when you look at real data, this is how they look like. So here it's for yeast protein-protein interaction networks. So you have this sort of degree distribution. So here it's the PK degree distribution here, and this GK, the average connectivities of neighbors. And you see that they just sort of have these sort of trains with some nodes that have very large degrees. Right? So that means that here you have some nodes with large degrees and many nodes, many holes in distribution in this distribution. So if you kind of average out this, you get something like this, and you can approximate this law as you see with power laws in this log degree. So clearly this network, they are not random. A random network would look like something like this. It's more like an exponential distribution. That is, if you take the same number of edges and nodes as before, let's say 5,000 nodes and 10,000 edges, you connect them randomly, you get some sort of exponential distribution like this, with many nodes on the periphery with just one partner, and hardly any node with many partners. Real networks, they look like more like this, with many nodes as well with very few partners, and also a few nodes with many partners. So that's called these hubs. So now you can look at the different properties of these hubs, whether they can share many partners simultaneously or not. You can also look at oriented networks and look at the same sort of properties. So now in an oriented network, like a transcription networks or signal transduction network, you have in degrees where the arrows comes to the node, and you have out degrees, and they have typically very different distributions. And again, clearly different from random networks. So that's again this in and out degree for this data set, and you can see that the two distributions are quite different. The out degree is typically scale-free, as for protein-protein interaction network, and the in degree it is much more as essentially no hubs, so it's much faster decay. So this is for local properties. You can look at, you know, less local properties like motifs, and especially overrepresented motifs in this network, like autoregulatory loops, feedforward loops, and so on. And when you do that and you compare what you find with the randomized version of your network, again, you find, as you all know, that these biological networks, they really do not seem to be random. Okay, so that's very well known. So in fact, the question we'd like to ask is whether this, what we observe, this, the fact that this random, this network are not random, is it for some sort of functional reason, or is it just because, you know, by construction they simply cannot be random? So in that case, you may even wonder why. I mean, what's the point in that case to compare this biological network with some randomized version if they can even end up not being random by construction during evolution. So this is the sort of aspect we would like to focus on and see what are the constraints in the elementary evolutionary process that gave rise and to these networks. What are these constructive constraints that limited some of the properties in this network? So the typical ingredients we include in these sort of models are the mutations. So now you have a genome, not a gene, just mutates with some rate. So so typically it's a 10 to the minus 3 fixed mutation per nucleotide per million years. So that's the divergence part where these genes never end up mutating. But also, you get more genes by duplication of extant genes, and this leads to a fixed event. So, a new gene, 10 to the minus 3 new genes per million year in a typical genome. So that's for single gene duplication. But you also have in this genome whole genome duplications. It's much rarer. It's typically one fixed whole genome duplication per 100 or 200 million years. But now, considering the fact that it's obviously the whole genome, if you assume, say, a 10,000 gene genome for a typical eukaryote, then you get the same number of fixed genes for the same period of time per million years. So it tells you that this local genome duplication, the whole genome duplication, at some point, they should contribute about the same. But obviously, the evolutionary path is very different when you duplicate genes one at a time, and or when you double the genome at a given time. So that was on the genome side, and what we're interested in is what occurs on the network. Okay, so there's some sort of mapping. So now when, yeah. Yeah. I'll come to that. So eventually you have deletion of genes. Genes will be lost when they lose their neighbors. So they lose their neighbors when, so a gene that had previously some neighbors, by mutation might lose some neighbors, and when it has no neighbors, we'll assume that is lost. So that's how you lose them. Okay, so mutations, so that's exactly what we just said. So mutations, essentially, what we'll assume is that by mutating a gene, the most likely outcome will be to lose some connections. Okay? It's much less likely to create de novo interaction with this process. So the way you create de novo interaction is by, in fact, duplicating genes. So now if you take this given gene, you just duplicate it. Initially, the two copies are identical, so they share the same partners, and here you just double the interactions. So that's for local duplication. You also have whole genome duplication, as we just saw. And in that case, each interaction is multiplied by 4 between the two copies, simultaneous copies of the the partners. Yeah.
So this vitality where some connections are destroyed but not others are destroyed by mutations.
Yeah.
So isn't this in any observations, because the little papers out there that rewiring, when you look at orthologs and you look at complex memberships, yeah, it's very rare that proteins would change some of the partners. So is this model founded in any sort of data, or this is more hypothesis of
how things work? Yeah, I'll show you in a second precisely this. I mean, this, the data part that supports this, obviously, because they are data, so we should look at them and see whether it fits in any way what we were saying. So I'll come to that right after this, in fact. So here is just to illustrate this whole genome, well, on this side, what we just said. So in the last few years, I just tried to keep track of the whole genome duplication that came out. So this graph is becoming quite heavy, as you can see. So in fact, indeed, I mean, there are essentially whole genome duplications in succession in all major eukaryote branches. So the most well known are for vertebrates right here, with these two ancient whole genome duplication at the the base of vertebrates, essentially. Bony fish just got another one some 250 million years ago. There are many in plants. More and more we realize that they're also in vertebrates. This is the well-known in whole genome duplication in yeast. Even protists have, so can you, so this is definitely, this is cut, okay. So maybe I wanted to underline this also. So now when you have a whole genome duplication, obviously it's a major change in the genome, so it means that essentially you cannot cross with any of your relatives. So it creates huge bottlenecks, or tiny bottlenecks rather, in population. So obviously this effect at some point relates to population dynamics also, essentially by saying that with this sort of event, you kind of escape, you know, traditional adaptive selection mechanisms, because we cannot really talk about a population anymore at each of these events. And as you can see, they occur somewhat regularly in all branches.
Question, is the rate set by the rate at which duplications happen at all, or is it set by some other event?
The
rate? Some cataclysm that destroyed a whole bunch of phyla and changed the environment in such a way that now something which has gene
duplication has a thickness
event. Is it known that
this
occurred
with effort? So what I just said is that essentially there is no, I mean, there cannot be any fitness advantage with this sort of approach, because, you know, fitness means that you have, you kind of impose your genes to your partner. But here you cannot even cross with the partner.
There are people who have extra copies of X chromosomes. They are not lethal.
Yes.
But it could be that the environment changes in such a way that they have a selective advantage. So the question is, are these events correlated with
no, no, and I think in fact they are not. So I think that it's essentially purely random. So maybe to address your question, the background rate of whole genome duplication is actually quite high. For instance, in human, it's known that about a few 1 or 2% of miscarriage are due exactly to tetraploidization event, and sometimes in fact you get even a newborn that live for a few months or even a few years that are full tetraploids. Obviously it doesn't give them any fitness advantage, far from it. So it's likely that this is what happened with all these species, and maybe the most interesting, or the most information can be found in the recent recently duplicated species. So recent here means a few million years or tens of million years. And okay, so I mean, you know, this frog here that has essentially twice as many genes as this one, Xenopus tropicalis and Xenopus laevis. I mean, to me, it sounds like there is no fitness advantage whatsoever. In fact, probably it was a huge barrier to overcome the fact that you doubled your genome. So the fixation rate, so although the background rate is very high, the fixation rate is very low. And for instance, it has been studied a little bit in plants. So in plants, people have realized that when you engineer a species with a double genome, then initially, almost immediately, so at the first generation, you in order to fix the two genomes, you have to have essentially epigenetic phenomenon that silence some of the regions in two copies. So there probably are some sort of mechanism like this that are required to give some descendants. But on short time scales, first you cannot compete with anybody because you cannot try to convince, you know, you cannot cross with any other species.
The barbary next was on duplication in humans, where one of them shut down in females. You could imagine that such.
Yeah, no, exactly. You see, although here it seems to be more region of the double chromosomes. okay, so that's for the bottleneck. And okay, so now the other aspect here, I think, is okay. So now imagine you have, once you've doubled your genome, okay, so most of the time you cannot make it. I mean, this is too big of a change, so nothing happens. Very rarely somehow you make it, probably by pure chance. And then over million of years or tens of million of years, what happens is all this redundancy is reduced by deleting typically one copy of each of most of these duplicated pairs. But you essentially do it randomly. So very rapidly, even the descendants of this one, let's say, one individual that had this double genome cannot cross each other because they have deleted different copies on their genome. So it's also a very efficient way to promote speciation after such an event, if you make it on the early stage. So maybe, you know, these two whole genome duplication early on here allowed some sort of speciation radiation along this branch. Okay, so this is cut. I'll cut it. So let's go back to the data. If you go to the yeast protein-protein interaction network, and you know that there was this whole genome duplication some 100 or 150 million years ago, this is what we want to test. So the picture is like this. So at some point there was this whole genome duplication that we just described. so all links were multiplied by 4. Then you have the divergence. So most of these copies, as we saw, eventually get reduced to one copy per duplicate because you lose the connections. but some remain. So there are about 10% of the genome that is still in two copies from this event. And we know for sure that because of the synteny in the genomes, that which pairs are were duplicated in this event. So it's also a nice way to calibrate this thing. So after divergence, you get something like this. And if the scenario we just outlined is correct, then you expect that these pairs somehow share more neighbors, more partners that have arisen by this whole genome duplication. So they should share more partners than say random pairs. So also you can have rewiring, as we just mentioned. So in principle, you can imagine. So in the model that I'll explain later on, we will neglect this possibility. So essentially, there will be no rewiring. But here, we cannot exclude, obviously, in the data that there was some rewiring. So the only thing we can tell is that if the rewiring was really, very important, then it should just wipe out the signal that this pair might share more partners. Okay, so that's sort of a measure of this. So now if you really look at the data, you can look at pairs that were that are still in duplicate, so that's in green here, and other pairs in blue, that's probably all genome in blue. So if you look at the degree distribution, they are essentially the same, so there is no bias here. But now if you look at the probability to share a neighbor, you can see that the pairs that come from this whole genome duplication are much more likely to share neighbors than random pairs. So if you ask for at least one neighbor, it's they're 20 times more likely to share partners. If you ask for many neighbors, 10 neighbors, say, they are 1,000 times more likely to share neighbors.
So why do you not expect also them to have slightly higher degree distribution? Because when you duplicate, you basically double your
Well, the higher degree would be this one, not this one. So that's all the background. So now we'd like to try to see if we can do something quantitative about this model. So obviously we were not the first to try to model this evolution of large networks by gene duplications. But as you just realize, especially in a whole genome duplication, everything will come very rapidly, very large, so exponentially fast, obviously. And even if you think about it, local genes, if they are independent, the growth of the gene and the network should be exponential as well. So this is the frame we'd like to address here. So I'll describe this model here. So that's the picture. You have a genome network that maps onto this genome, and so interaction between this node. At some point, you pick a random fraction of these genes and duplicate them. So if Q is very small, you're doing essentially local gene duplication. If Q equal 1, this is a whole genome duplication. And you have the corresponding picture on the network side. So initially, the genes are identical, so things are essentially symmetric. But as we just saw, typically one of the copy will disappear while the other will stay. So obviously, they have a different fate. You have to include that in the model by assuming that these guys can diverge asymmetrically. So this is the sort of picture we have with three colors. So the genes that are not duplicated, the genes that are duplicated, some will evolve quite fast. That's the light blue, and some will be essentially conserved and evolve more slowly. That's these guys. And already you see that you have quite a few combinations of interactions between those guys. So in this model, the idea is to, given this event, just write, work out the statistics. I mean, so you now assume that there are some sort of, there are some probability to keep interactions, some of these duplicated and not duplicated interaction between the different partners, and you assume that the, these probabilities will only depend on the type of partner they have. So there are three types of partners.
You don't assume that highly connected ones are less likely to
be related? Well, yeah, at some point, yes. I mean, at some point it will come out, but the model is like this. Okay, so you just assume that the probability to keep a link is only related to the color of the partner. So, you know, highly conserved partner, you expect will have a very small chance to lose their connection. So delta will be tiny. On the other hand, highly evolved partner will be very likely to lose that. So what?
How do we know that there's an asymmetric divergence, that one evolves more rapidly?
I mean, from data, we know that after duplication, 90% of the time, after, you know, 100 million years, one copy will be gone. So obviously, they have different fates. So they cannot really treat this problem assuming a perfect symmetry.
So that just could be a single, that could be a single event by chance one goes, rather than saying that there's a speed. I thought you were implying that one of them was a speeding up of the evolution of one of them, rather than.
Yes, I mean, then you can make any. No, I agree. You can make any assumption behind the model. let's say asymmetric is more general than symmetric, since it, you know, symmetric is included in asymmetric. So
couldn't you test that in the phylogeny that you showed, where you can try to identify chromosomes? You know which chromosomes duplicate. You can find orthologs of genes.
So we have not done that, so I cannot really talk about it. But obviously, there are people that have done that, and I think it sort of fit with what I'm saying. That
there could be more subtle effects as well, which you might be ignoring, such as the X duplication, which gave rise to males and females. And clearly, the Y chromosome is less relevant than the X chromosome. That's because something happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it has this one gene, which is maleness specific, and
you're not talking about the Y chromosome,
no,
you're talking about the
genes. Yeah, but in the end, you're talking about general things, you're talking about gene duplication in general, about chromosome duplication in general, right? So, how can, then there should be evidence in yeast that this network, this is the way the network evolved. So, I mean, if you put that orthologies, which have this property, then you will believe the model.
I mean, there's all kinds of literature on what happens to duplicates, right?
Yes.
There's some evidence that there's asymmetric divergence of duplicates, and in some duplicates it doesn't look like there's asymmetric divergence, okay? But as a simple abstract model, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying these rates are plausibly might be different.
Yeah, but if they are the same, it's also a special case of this case. So what's your, it's less restrictive than symmetric. Yes. Yeah.
In reality, many of those interactions reflect stable protein complexes, or some of them may not be stable but functional units.
Mm-hmm.
So do you assume independence of those deletion of links, where you have some block structure, so you just change your complex membership or change your...
Yes, so that's right. So here you assume independence, not quite in the sense that, you know, all the links connected to this guy would be affected by it, you know, by its color. So the correlation comes from the local color, okay? But then you that's true that you will pick the different part, you will delete or keep the different partners independently. Although you might have a very strong bias to keep them all or delete them all. Okay, so as it turns that, this is the model. So now there are genes that will end up without a connection after this step here, deletion step, and they will be assumed to be non-functional and removed from the network, and then you start from here and iterate. So as it turns, so this model can be solved exactly. So we know exactly what will happen in general. We have solved the phase space of this problem. So just as a brief summary, things are rather simple. So by this dynamics, you have two possibilities only. So either the network grows exponentially or shrink exponentially. So obviously we'll be interested in growing networks. And for these growing networks, they are either non-stationary or stationary with respect to the degree distribution. So in fact, non-stationary networks, they are kind of networks that become denser and denser. So the number of links grows exponentially faster than the number of nodes, so it becomes a ball of connected nodes. Especially there are no nodes with a few connections. So this is certainly not a very biologically relevant regime, but obviously it exists. So more likely we're interested in the stationary networks. And for these stationary networks, there are also two possibilities only. Either the degree distribution that becomes stationary falls in the exponential category. So essentially the networks really looks like a very fragmented network in general case. Or you end up with a stationary scale-free distribution that would look like this. So this is all there is in this model. And okay, so there are then a few global parameters that will control this problem. So the parameter we just alluded to is the topology parameter, which is M prime. But there are other and also gamma, the growing the network. There is also another interesting parameter, which is M, that control the conservation of the network. Conservation means, so you see the there are intermediate parameters that are this capital gamma I that control the rate at which each node, the connection of each node increases or decreases. So there is one gamma I per color, so per three color. And then this combination of gamma I gives you the rate of a network, of the global network growth. So we'll be interested in gamma larger than one. And now you see that M, this combination here, it's at each duplication you pick either the gene is not duplicated, with a probability 1 minus q, so its degree will increase like gamma s in that case, or it's duplicated and the most conserved copy will see its connection increase with gamma naught. So m is kind of the average growth of connectivity growth of the most conserved descent of a node. So if m is larger, so it means that each node, if we follow a node over time, you will get more and more connections, so you'll stick in the network and be conserved over time. or if m is smaller than 1, then you know that it will lose its connection, so at some point it will just be removed from the network. And you see that this is done. Okay, so here I just outlined this model like this, but in fact, at each iteration you can pick, you can change all parameters, so you can just pick different parameters each time, and essentially the conclusion holds, and you have in particular very stringent relation between these global parameters that do not depend on the small values of the evolutionary history of the network. So in principle, in this model, you can include variation in all parameters, even fluctuations in all the parameters, and the conclusion at the end will still hold. So in particular, you see that m, whatever the parameters is always smaller than gamma. So it means that there are only three possible regimes here. Either both parameters are smaller than 1, or 1 is in the middle, or they're both larger than 1. So here is, you have no network, there is nothing to talk about. So when gamma is larger than 1, you have network. So here, again, the when you follow the descent of a given node, because m is smaller than 1, it will just disappear at some point. But still, you have a network, and this network comes from sort of a fluctuation. There was at some point a node that was probably more connected than the other ones, and it gives rise to all the other nodes in the network you observed right now. So this is a very peculiar regime where you know, all the genes here will resemble, will be more closely similar to one another than to any other gene in some other species. So another species will be another scenario like this. So in the same regime, these genes will be all closely resembling. So obviously this non-conserved regime doesn't really look like the biologically relevant ones. We know that actin from animals and from plants are more closely resembling than you know, any membrane protein from any of these species. So we're probably in this regime where m essentially is larger than 1.
So yeah. Only conserved networks mean that the links have a finite chance, or that their average lifetime divergence or something like that?
Yeah, that they just stick forever. Well, once you've been duplicated and once a gene has been duplicated in the genome, then statistically you will have a descent. That's what it means. Obviously by fluctuation some of them will be gone, but statistically they'll have
but it's not that there will be a finite chance for anything to get lost, so that everything is going to have a finite lifetime. Somehow there are links that can live forever.
There are links that are forever? No. Links, they will all die out at some point.
What is the quantitative difference then between links that are all very recent, and some cases where you have very old links, but they still disappear at some point?
So I'll come to that precise point. So the conservation, so this conservation, so here I put conservation, but it's really gene conservation or protein conservation. It's not the connection, the neighbor. So it's really, I'll come precisely to this point in a second.
So we do have homologs, similar proteins duplicated many times, sometimes even on different chromosomes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, couldn't that be what you just discarded as not possible? I mean, you said that, so can you go back to the next slide if you find? You had this.
No, next time. Yeah. This one? Yeah.
So in the non-conserved network, you have all these things that presumably derive from what? A common ancestral protein?
Yes. So the
similar, and they would have recent ancestry.
Yeah.
But such proteins do exist.
Yeah, but here hits the whole network. So I'll come also to this point. So here, so far, we have some sort of homogeneous network.
So these are all proteins in the network, not just one.
Yes. So here it's the network.
Yeah.
We were talking about the network. So here, all the proteins on the network, they all come from this, in this regime. Okay? Some sort of fluctuation. But it's very peculiar regime that exists, but doesn't really fit in the what was there. So the biological networks in this homogeneous model where all the genes are treated the same, they look like in this regime. Okay, so now if indeed we think that n should be larger than 1, you see that because of this relation we have between these parameters, especially this parameter controlling topology and parameter controlling history of the network, we know that in this regime n prime should also be larger than 1. So that means that in this model, without although you know this topology and conservation of the network in general have no reason to be connected. I mean, if you take any evolutionary dynamics on this network, there are very different properties of the network. You should be able to construct anything. But you see that if you limit yourself, if you restrict yourself to these rules of evolving only by duplication divergence, which I think most people think that it's what control and governs the evolution of this genome and network, then you see that there are very strong connection between seemingly different properties. So here you see that if the network is conserved, if you're in this regime, then you know that necessarily the topology also is scale-free without any condition on the on without any apparent function playing a role here. So far I'll go maybe fast here. We didn't talk about loops. I mean, genes that can interact. There is a question. No.
Yeah, very philosophical question, because we're talking, as far as I understand, you're talking about stationary properties of networks as provided by some evolutionary models, right? Now, the question is, and you showed the rates of the processes, and the processes are very slow, and the whole story is at most 4 billion years, because before there was no life. So what is the basis for looking at stationary solutions rather than looking at something which happened, started reasonably recently and is progressing?
No, but here we look at all solutions. Because that's the nice thing here, is you actually solve the problem exactly, so you know all solutions, and you see that the only other solutions are really not corresponding to anything we observed. Because the non-stationary solution either means that the genome just disappears, so you have nothing to talk about, or all the networks become densely connected.
But I think he's talking about the
transient thing. Yeah. Right. So. But you know, everything has.
Maybe that we're in a very early stage of the game with so little time.
Right. So first point, everything is exponential. So you know, the transient states they exponentially go somewhere anyway. So that's first thing. And second thing is, actually, we can even from data. Maybe if I have some time, I'll show you comparison with data. We can infer that, for instance, for yeast, the data look like they are in the stationary regime. They're all signature of this. So I didn't talk about small loops so far, although, and in particular because connecting genes obviously can create interaction between pairs that we didn't have so far. But in fact, the reason I didn't mention them earlier is that this only brings some sort of time linear increase in the degree distribution. It's only 1 + 1 connection, and this is, in fact, overwhelmed by the underlying exponential dynamics of this project. So it really doesn't change the picture. You can solve it adding the loops as well, but it won't change much of the discussion we've just had. But obviously, that there was only for a degree distribution. This loop, they play a role, and a very important role for certain motifs, for instance, if you are interested in motifs. So for the motifs, things become very much more complicated. You can still do exact things. I won't show you this result now. But there are also very simple things that you can say about motifs. And the simple things are about conservation of motifs. So so far we discussed the conservation of the simplest motif, which is a single gene, and we saw that presumably this network needed to be in a regime where this parameter M that control the conservation of genes should be larger than one. But you see now, if you look at more complex motifs that include different genes and interactions between them, you immediately see that because you have these interactions, and in this model again, they have some finite probability to be deleted over evolutionary timescales, you know that even though the genes making up these motifs might be in the conserved regime, so all these guys have a descent, their connections at some point will be gone, and the motifs per se will disappear. So you can translate that by saying that eventually this structural ontology that if you compare different species, the proteins will be conserved, that connection at the level of motifs will be gone. And obviously the functions are more in the interaction between partners, as we just say, in the combinatorics of interactions. So that would represent some sort of function. And you know that this guy, if you wait long enough in different branches of the phylogeny, it will be gone. So the functional ontology will, at some point, be gone. And you don't need to add rewiring in this model. So we have no rewiring so far, but already at the level of duplication divergence, it's there. And in fact, if you look at distant enough species, this is what you typically observe, that although we can identify autologs, they do not have the same function anymore. It doesn't mean that the function has disappeared, but it means, so most likely the function was passed on to some newer copies of one of these genes at some point. So this interaction that is lost, we know that statistically it should be kept nevertheless, so it's kept, but in some other copy. So if you follow the most conserved autologs, they won't talk to each other anymore and carry out the same properties, but this function probably will be carried on by some something else. okay. Yeah.
You say this is in broad agreement with empirical observations, but there are also proteins that do the same thing in all organisms, right? I mean, maintain their function for as long as we can.
So like what?
Well, things like,
Many organisms don't have hemoglobin.
The ribosome and polymerase,
yeah, but you have different types of polymerase. For instance, if you look at actin, which is highly conserved, well, in bacteria you have some homologs of actin, and they do something quite different. So I still think that this broadly holds. Obviously, if you look at the more closely the species are, the more likely they are to share exactly the same functions with their autologs. That's clear, because obviously this non-conservation of motifs will take time. That's
even within an organism, there are proteins that function differently in embryo. The same protein, but it has a different function in embryo than in a differentiated adult. It's not the only evolutionary pressure on it. There's other things that happen continuously on comes from independent of implication at all, which have to do with evolution of complexity.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's put it like this. If you take a protein in yeast, right, and you find the human ortholog of this protein, I guess most people will make as the first assumption that it will do something similar in your human as it will do in yeast, right?
I know.
And the other way around, right? So,
No, I know, but also many people realize, you know, this functional transfer of annotation is very difficult and has many problems. So I know that it's obviously the first assumption everybody would like to make, because that's, you know, the, more or less the only one that what can make. But very often you realize that it simply doesn't work, especially when you compare with the, you know, organisms that are that have diverged from a very long time.
You have two duplications here, because there is a difference between ortholog and paralog. So when you're talking the same gene here, you're not talking about orthology versus paralogy. So it's paralog as well.
Yes.
Then the point is better.
But I mean, just to take on the same topic, this model would sort of predict that necessarily functional interactions would decay in a given network type faster than the ingredients. Then at the level of single proteins.
Yes.
So even if you would say, even if you have the protein, the first hypothesis would be that its functional connections would have changed.
Mm-hmm.
That they are more volatile.
Yes.
Proteins, but then I guess most people would agree that the rates of conservation of these objects are very heterogeneous.
Yes.
There
yes.
are network kernels that maybe live.
Absolutely. No. So absolutely. So this rate, I mean, we have not said anything that except that this gamma, you know, it's cannot be exactly one, because you still have background mutations and all this, but they can be very, very close to one for certain complexes, say. So while in some other, so there are actually some heterogeneity that is not in this model here. So maybe I can jump to this precise aspect. So far, everything was homogeneous. So all, you know, we just have one type of proteins. But in principle, one might like to say, well, you know, obviously proteins are not all the same, so they might evolve, they might have different, still in the same sort of general evolutionary model, but with more colors, let's say. So in fact, although we've solved the problem, the general problem when everything is homogeneous, we can convince yourself that you cannot do it, you know, in general, if you had as many colors as you want. So this we cannot really do. But there are still very powerful way we can sort of circumvent this problem. as I told you before, in the homogeneous case, you can, because you can add any variation of fluctuation in the parameters, you can even choose them a posteriori. So now I can, when I draw randomly my parameters. So let's say I want to pick a very small, tiny fraction of my network and duplicate it. Now I can say when I duplicate a particular node, let's say this one, then I can realize, oh, but this is this node. So now I can pick my parameters differently, because I have this flexibility. So now I say, well, when I pick this node 4, well, then I can choose a bunch of gammas that are very particular and do this thing. so by picking these parameters, a posteriori each time, I can sort of mimic the adaptation, or either positive or negative selection, of some features of the network, even combinatorial features, because that's what we saw. All this network and is all about.
So this is not exact, but it can really be useful to address some aspect, like the adaptive expansion of gene families. We just discussed it. So say, well, this gene is very special. Each time I pick it, then I choose my parameters differently. So obviously now we've in this way you kind of introduce colors in your graph, because obviously this guy now has a different color. and so that means that now we have to talk about locally different properties for these particular genes that you're interested that will have his family expanded or not. But there are rooms to do things here. And in fact, there are some cases where the problem can still be tractable exactly. This is when you have essentially two colors only, or equivalently when you have when you talk about oriented networks, where you have this incoming and out going arrows. So still you can do everything exactly with this two colors network. So I will maybe try to tell you briefly some things about these oriented networks. So when you look at the data this time of E. coli transcription network, you realize that this transcription network is a very simple and peculiar shape. It's a very hierarchical network with a few layers, with the global regulatory genes on top that regulate all the transcription factor, then themselves eventually regulate target genes. And you really have few layers, essentially no feedback from the bottom layers to the top layers. There are a few, but very little. And yet, more than 50% of the transcription factors regulate their own expression. So the feedback, actually you have a lot, but it's local, not global. So now when you introduce an arrow, so when you talk about oriented networks, in this sort of frame we just described, when you everything evolved by duplication, so you can convince yourself by looking at the data that this transcription network of E. coli evolved by duplication and create some families of transcription factors. So now within this model, it's quite clear that there are some differences by duplicating the targets or the regulators. And in fact, typically, it will be much, much more likely to accept a duplication like this than like this. Essentially because when you duplicate a target, everything that was working before, let's say in black, so not only this arrow, but all the rest, well, still works. And this regulator has one more target, so typically, as we saw, they have many targets, so one, or if you have 10 or 11 targets or 100 or 101 targets, doesn't really change much the picture. So this is very acceptable. While obviously this is quite different, because now when the two copies of the regulator will start to diverge, you'll get interference. So what was working before will be most likely perturbed by this event. So in general, you have this regulatory conflict, so it's much less likely that you can accept this than this. So there's some asymmetry.
If, for example, the DNA binding domain of the transcription factor diverges, there doesn't seem to be any conflict.
No. So here this is the same target gene with its single region, promoter region, let's say, but you duplicate some sort of transcription factor.
Right. Okay.
So you have two copies. But it's the same. I mean, initially it's the same binding domain.
Right, but okay? Initially then also the only thing that changes is the amount of that transcription factor.
Actually,
yes.
The variance might also change. It actually might be more robust, right? If it's actually, averaging over noise by both genes, I can see that being an improvement.
So in general, you... in general, this guy will see the effect of both. Okay, I mean, at first it's just a dosage, if you want, because you have two copies now. So this can be.
Auto-regulatory, maybe they will just automatically regulate the dosage we have, right? I mean,
right.
I think it's very hard to make these sort of general statements to say, well, this per definition is more likely to be selectively okay than that.
Well, here.
It's pretty tough to make such a.
Well, the only thing you can say is that in this scenario, all the targets of the duplicated guy, so there are typically 110 or 100 targets, they will all feel the duplicated regulatory gene, duplicated transcription factor, the two copies. And now if these two copies, so initially you have eventually this dosage effect, but eventually the two copies will diverge, and you can, so it will affect all the targets in general. So it might be good in some time. I'm not saying it's never good. It could be good, but in general, it will affect. So what was working perfectly well before might not work that well afterwards. So typically, this will result in trying to remove one of these arrows. So each time you duplicate the regulatory gene, if you can get rid of one of these, you know, the system will go back to normal, let's say, and so it will, what was working before will work after. So typically, you would like to remove one of these arrow in that case. What we observe is that so. The trick is that this autoregulatory transcription factor, when they got duplicated, they should talk to each other, and somehow you don't see the trace of these crosstalks, so they somehow got eliminated. So that's the picture when you duplicate an autoregulator. Here, for bacteria, it's almost systematic that you get rid of the crosstalks, okay? Because otherwise, you will have, you know, eventually you will have large feedbacks in this network, and there is no trace of this. So somehow, this occurred. Now, when you look at Cerevisia, it's something. Things seem to be much more random, if we can say. So although you also need, in principle, I think, to get rid of one of these duplicated arrow each time, well, you can essentially pick either one. So either regulatory link or the crosstalk.
So what are the data?
So this is for E. coli, it's regular DB data. For Subtilis, there's also much less data, I must say, but there are also some equivalent data, but much. So I can find the exact reference for you, and for Cerevisia as well. But again, I need to look up the precise data set. but that's what comes out of the data. So here it's some sort of measure of the length of the transcription cascade. So for bacteria, what you find is that these transcription cascades are quite short, and compared to, you know, some sort of randomized version of the network. While for Cerevisia, it's essentially the opposite. So you get much longer transcription cascade that you would expect. A priori, and this somehow fits with this evolutionary events where you just remove, let's say, randomly these redundant duplicated cross links. So here,
you didn't just go and take analogous pairs of transcription factors and look how often they are in the regular DB claimed to be regulating each other, and they compare this with some expectation or something. you looked at some more global statistics like the average depth of the morphology.
Yes, yes. And other properties as well. The sort of the regulatory kernel that cannot is not a simple tree of regulations. But I'll can give you some more data on this. okay, so that seems to be the picture, and because it's different, one might think, well, maybe it's some sort of here it looks like random, here it looks not that random, so maybe it's here for some reason. and obviously, so if this is the case, then at some point it should be coupled to population dynamics with some sort of effective parameter that tells you in which regime you are. So I think that will be the basic assumption here. but in fact, it's not the reason. Maybe it's not the reason why bacteria tend to do this might not be for any functional purpose. So there are many other reasons that might come up, and they're all again related to some sort of constraints. So everything might be essentially random within a frame of constraints that are specific to the system, so here to bacteria. So we know that for bacteria you have some sort of transcription-translation coupling because the way bacteria are assembled, let's say, while for eukaryotes you have this export in and out of the nucleus, so obviously the messenger RNA, you don't really know once you export them from the nucleus where they come from which copy they come from, while if you have to couple, or if you just couple by construction, transcription and translation, you know very well where the messenger RNA comes from, and then all these arrows that we draw as equivalent might not be really equivalent because of this sort of constraint. There are other constraints in bacteria that you might think of, which is just the singular nature of this genome. In fact, when you look when you look at the typical bacterial genome, it looks like surprisingly constrained. In fact, so you. The order of these genes is seems to be constrained. You cannot just shuffle as you want the genes. And when you compare species that have diverged for a while, you still see a very clear signature of the fact that you cannot just random genes that freely, although we all know that you can still add many new genes or remove genes by gene transfer in the genome. So there's some sort of paradoxical. This is two genomes, so that's the number of genes, 4,000 genes. And then you just plot, these plots are the most similar autologs in each species. And you see that they sort of align in two ways in this sort of cross. and obviously you still have many dots outside that most likely come from a gene transfer. So you can...
How are the genes sorted?
Oh, it's just the genome. So the circular genome, you cut it somewhere, maybe at... sequence, yeah. Yeah. So it's the open cycle. One reason that is often... a claim here is that there might be some sort of dosage effect, because if you're close to the origin of replication, then typically in bacteria your genome is in double copy so genes that will be closer to this origin, so I don't know if it's this one or this one, but one of the two might be affected by dosage. If you just shuffle, if you take this guy and put it there, then it should have an effect. But yet, as we just said, you can still add squeezing or removed genes very easily by gene transfer. So it seems that, okay, this dodge maybe is not the answer. Yeah, I'm not just. This is the last few slides. I mean, it's very speculative, but just to point out that there are rooms for other explanations that just functional adaptation in all these observations. So an alternative way might not be really this dosage, but you know, something that is much more related to the actual structure of this bacterial genome. So maybe the only way you can exchange genes in a genome is just by a correlated inversion around this point, because in space this genome is structured, and that's the only thing you can get. And in fact, even gene transfer, you might wonder whether this is does not really result from a constraint itself. So if you now imagine that for instance, the transcription network arises by gene duplication. But now if you imagine that this circular chromosome somehow is a constraint, it tells you that the bacterial chromosome cannot grow forever. And in fact, we know that bacterial chromosome, they're all more or less the same size. I mean, there is a one order of magnitude in size, more or less, for bacteria, while for eukaryotes there are five orders of magnitude or even more. So it's very reasonable that there is some sort of space constraint. So now if you make up this model that we just did, by when you duplicate some genes, you have some sort of background duplication of genes, but with some sort of space constraints, obviously it tells you that you have to have a gene turnover. So if you duplicate genes, you have to remove some. And if you do this, essentially, it looks like you cannot really evolve, because each time you invent something useful, if you at some point you get rid of it, this is a problem. So if you impose also the reasonable constraint that you want to conserve what actually works, the only way out, if you have to remove things, you also have to be able to exchange genes that work. So this genes transfer, you might think of as a direct consequence of these global constraints. And this is, for instance, and this is actually a counterexample. There are always counterexamples in biology. So here is actually one of the few bacteria that has a non-circular genome. So it's an open genome. And in fact, it has grown much larger than typical bacterial genome. So it has more or less twice as many genes as E. coli, and many duplications that are in these branches, which might suggest that indeed you have some sort of, because of the circularity of this genome, somehow you have a space constraint. And if somehow you escape this constraint by opening the genomes, then things indeed start to grow. So I think I've passed my time. I'd like to thank you.